The world is supported by Wise, the smart new way to move money internationally. Imagine a world where you could speak any language, travel to any place, and spend in any currency with ease. At Wise, they're building the money part. Wise is the world's most international account. It lets you hold and convert dozens of currencies all in one place. And you always get the real exchange rate with no markups like the banks sometimes give you. So whether you're sending money to Australia, hopping on a plane to Poland, or getting paid from France, Wise is all you need. Designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
The U.S. response to the 9/11 attacks was quick, massive, and also incomplete.
In our foreign policy, we also have to listen more to the people that we are seeking to either help or advance our interests with in other countries.
Former Obama advisor Ben Rhodes on how America's role in the world has shifted in 20 years. Also today...
Unfortunately, while in much of the world, 9/11 is viewed as in the past, in Africa, the legacy of those attacks lives on.
Today, there are more militant extremists in Africa than on 9/11. I'm Marco Werman, and looking for a real-life Cinderella story? Check out the women's tennis final at the U.S. Open this weekend.
Very surprising to see the two of them, unheralded, two unseeded players.
Teenagers romping at the finals and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us today. In Afghanistan, we now know more about who's running the country. The Taliban announced an interim government this week. They're all men. They're all Taliban insiders. The Taliban have also adopted a new official name for Afghanistan, the Islamic Emirate. As the world's Shirin Jafari found when she was on assignment in Kabul, there are lingering questions about which version of Islam will take precedence.
It's time for Friday prayers at one of Kabul's main mosques. Men, young and old, kick off their shoes, rush inside, roll up their sleeves, and get ready for the weekly sermon. Sheikh Abdullah Nur Abad is preaching today. He's sitting up front on a raised chair, holding a microphone that helps project his voice across the mosque. The men sit on the floor in rows, and then off to the side, there's a small room tucked away in a corner for the women. On this Friday in August, before the Taliban takeover, the atmosphere was already tense. During this sermon, Sheikh Nur Abad is cautious with his words, and he never mentions the Taliban. Afterwards, he declines to do a face-to-face interview with me, a woman, but he agrees to answer my questions as long as they're being read by my male colleague. And the question is this: what is his understanding of the Taliban's version of Islam? Fighting between Muslims is not justified, he says. True believers don't kill each other. They work on bringing peace. Nur Abad says he was a Talib himself at one point. He knows the teachings, he says, and went to the same type of schools as some of the Taliban fighters. But it seems like these men took away something entirely different, he says. Taliban's ideology grew out of a specific version of Islam, the Deobandi school. And it's different from the Islam that existed in Afghanistan in the past. That's according to Omar Sadr, who teaches political science at the American University of Afghanistan.
The traditional Islam practiced in Afghanistan was quite different. It is Islam as a faith for a majority of the people. And that is different from Islam being as an ideology.
The earlier Islam in Afghanistan, he says, was influenced by Sufi schools or tariqas.
Sufi tariqas were quite moderate, they were tolerant, they were accepting, it established a kind of order which was cosmopolitan, wherein it accepted diversity of the society and mutual coexistence.
Deobandi Islam was founded in northern India, not Afghanistan. And Islamic scholars say it came about as a response to British colonial rule. One man behind the movement was a scholar called Waliullah Dehlavi.
He was so much upset about how Muslims have been integrated within the Hindu community here. And so he constantly wrote against all this, and he preached that how we need to go back to Arabian model of Islam.
After the partition of 1947, Saad says, a branch of Deobandi called Hanafi Islam formed in Pakistan. With the support of the government, he says, schools began teaching it to students along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. Some of those students went on to fight in Afghanistan. Today, the Taliban call Afghanistan an Islamic Emirate. That means a religious leader or an emir will be the top authority. And governance will be based on Taliban's interpretation of Islam. That will impact all sorts of things in daily life, from, say, banking to how people should dress to segregation of men and women in public spaces.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم مسعود جامی هستم مسئول عمومی بخش خواهران جمعیت اصلاح در سطح افغانستان.
مسعود جامی is with the Jamiat Islah of Afghanistan, a movement that promotes Islamic thought and culture. She says the Islam she teaches to her students centers on peace and coexistence.
یکی از مهمترین قضایایی هست که در دین، یعنی اگه قرار بشه کسی به دین پایبند باشه، او کسی هست که نسبت به کل هم‌نوعانش خیرخواه است، خاصتاً نسبت به مؤمن.
In Islam, there is great emphasis on cleansing your heart of hatred against everyone, she says, but especially the faithful. So it's puzzling when the Taliban target and kill fellow Afghans. But for Jami, foreign interference in Afghanistan is what has made things worse.
یکی خوانمی قضیه هست که افرادگری در افغانستان حمایت شد و برای اونها بسیار
Extremism in Afghanistan was supported and funded by foreigners, she tells me. And that's unfortunate because now some people say they want nothing to do with Islam. Jami says the role of religious leaders is important moving forward. They should make sure people don't lose sight of moderate Islam.
ما فعلا هیچ چیزی نداریم. هیچ چیزی نداریم بعد از 20 سال حضور آمریکا در افغانستان. حتی داشته های ما از بین رفت.
After two decades of American presence, Afghanistan is a divided, heartbroken nation. It's time foreigners leave, she says, so we can focus on healing. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Go back 20 years tomorrow. Ben Rhodes was a 24-year-old grad student in New York City. On that Tuesday morning, September 11th, he was across the East River in Brooklyn with his eyes on Lower Manhattan.
We all started staring up at the World Trade Center and watching this billowing black smoke come out of it, not knowing what was going on. And while we're staring at it, I see the second plane curve around and plow into the tower. And for me, that was the moment when everything I was doing in my life changed.
Ben Rhodes went on to work for President Obama as a speechwriter and Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications. He recalled for us the path of war in Afghanistan as a response to the 9/11 attacks and how these past 20 years have impacted U.S. foreign policy.
When we went into Afghanistan, my presumption was we were going there to get the people who did 9/11. And when I look back at the arc, you know, what happens is we go into Afghanistan, we topple the Taliban, we put al-Qaeda on the run. We don't finish them off. Bin Laden escapes into Pakistan. And around that time, the U.S. government kind of shifts its attention in Afghanistan to nation building. And the Taliban begins to regenerate and begins to turn into an insurgency. And by the time we came into government in 2009 in the Obama administration, you had a situation where the Taliban was showing itself to be resilient. And so in 2009, you have a surge of forces. I do think between the years of 2009 and 2011, you see the kind of biggest successes in degrading al-Qaeda, but largely in Pakistan. And that culminates in the operation to take out Osama bin Laden in 2011. And then there's a period of time in which the United States is beginning to draw down its forces in Afghanistan and try to transition to Afghan security forces. And then Donald Trump initially surges a bit before kind of taking a sharp turn in the other direction, cutting a deal with the Taliban in 2020, in which he essentially agrees to withdraw U.S. forces in exchange for a promise from the Taliban to not shoot at us. But they continue, obviously, to fight the Afghan government and security forces. And Joe Biden comes into office and decides that he's going to complete the withdrawal. And when he does that, you have a collapse of the Afghan government security forces and a more resilient Taliban adversary obviously rolls into Kabul, and here we are.
That was a very thorough arc. Let's go back and talk about the surge. When your boss, Barack Obama, was president, there was an internal debate over what we know now as a surge. Then Vice President Biden was against the surge. What can you tell us about those internal debates and the thinking at the time?
at the time, the military, they basically recommend to Obama that he pursue a counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan along the lines of what they had done in the surge in Iraq. Obama was skeptical. He saw an enormous expenditure of resources that would go along with it, obviously huge risks to American troops, and a kind of unsolvable problem of a resilient Taliban that also had some safe haven in Pakistan. But Joe Biden at the table, he was the one person who said that he was against this, just dead set against it, that frankly, we couldn't nation build in Afghanistan, it wouldn't succeed, and that we should only think of Afghanistan in terms of finishing the counterterrorism mission against al-Qaeda. And that put him sharply at odds with the military, and there were some tense meetings there.
As you say, Ben Rhodes, the debates around that surge were sharp. What did that debate represent, though, in a kind of a larger sense, like America's role in the Middle East and the world?
Well, I think that the assumption undergirding the military's recommendation was that it was possible for the United States to essentially defeat the Taliban, stabilize Afghanistan, and construct an Afghan government and security force. And so I think what this whole debate is about is, can the United States remake other countries with our military? And look, I think that part of what we have to recognize is the degree to which a lot of the assumptions that we embraced as a country, that we could build governments in Iraq and Afghanistan, that's what the U.S. government set out to do. And it's a very hard thing to turn that machinery around.
I'm speaking with Ben Rhodes, Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications under Barack Obama. With the benefit of hindsight, what decisions did the Obama administration make in Afghanistan that you would redo?
Well, I think that the principal one is to have a smaller surge. The scale of that escalation in 2009, measured against what it ended up achieving, doesn't seem necessary. And then I think there's just the question of whether or not there was a better deal with the Taliban that could have been accomplished at some point than what Trump ended up doing. Because Trump's deal was essentially like, we're getting out. And Trump cut the Afghan government out of that deal. And that, to me, was the fundamental flaw, is to say the U.S. is negotiating its withdrawal, not with the Afghan government, but with the Taliban. And so I think the great unknown is whether or not at a different point, there could have been a better deal that led to a more orderly withdrawal and perhaps some kind of government that was, you know, brought in the Taliban, but also integrated elements of the Afghan government as it was.
All of this does lead us to some bigger questions, especially on the anniversary of 9/11. You often talk about being part of the 9/11 generation. What defines your generation? Like, it's a worldview.
I think the worldview is that it's a generation that came of age politically, largely after the Cold War. So we didn't have that organizing framework for how to think about America's role in the world. And when you have this massive event where you realize that history is not over, globalization is not inevitable, there was a generation of people that wanted to be a part of that post 9/11 response. I think part of what's so complicated is the period of time from 9/11 to the invasion of Iraq. That's when a lot of these decisions were made. To nation build in Afghanistan, to invade Iraq, the Patriot Act, the establishment of Guantanamo, all these things that we've basically been responding to since. And I think the 9/11 generation is a generation of people that, because we dealt with the aftermath of those policies, came to understand the limits of what America could accomplish in the post 9/11 period, particularly militarily. America does have a really important role to play in the world, and that a lot of people around the world look to the United States for various things in various ways. But we have to balance the necessity of America, I think, playing a significant role in the world against America not being overextended in ways that undermine our capacity to deal with the next generation of challenges, climate change, technology, the recession of democracy around the world, technology. We cannot deal with those things if we're fighting forever wars in multiple countries. And I think that's where the 9/11 generation is headed.
Ben Rhodes was a speechwriter and Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications in the Obama White House. His new book is After the Fall, Being American in the World We've Made. Ben Rhodes, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. When Al-Qaeda attacked the U.S. on 9/11, it sparked a new war, George W. Bush's so-called global war on terror. 20 years on, extremist groups like Al-Qaeda continue to pose a threat in the U.S., Europe, Asia, and increasingly in Africa. The World's Halima Gakande reports from Nairobi, Kenya, about the ongoing terror threat on the continent.
Years before 9/11, Al-Qaeda attacked the U.S. by hitting targets thousands of miles away. In 1998, they attacked two U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, killing 12 Americans and more than 200 Kenyans and Tanzanians. President Bill Clinton reacted swiftly.
Today, I ordered our armed forces to strike at terrorist-related facilities in Afghanistan and Sudan because of the imminent threat they presented to our national security.
Sudan had once harbored al-Qaeda members, including its leader, Osama bin Laden. Marithi Mutiga is with the International Crisis Group in Nairobi.
Al-Qaeda has had a long presence within the region. It may not have always been called al-Qaeda, but a form of jihadist core has existed within the region for decades.
In the 80s, Mutiga explains, a group of youth in Somalia and the region traveled to the mountains of Afghanistan to join the fight against the Soviets.
When bin Laden formed al-Qaeda and moved to Sudan in the early 90s, in 1991, there was an existing core of East Africans that he could tap into.
Decades later, al-Qaeda has inspired local terrorist groups across Africa that continue to wage deadly attacks. Mutiga says the global war on terror has not made the region any safer.
Unfortunately, while in much of the world, 911 is viewed as in the past, in Africa, the legacy of those attacks lives on. Today, there are more jihadis operating on the continent than there were 20 years ago.
2 years ago, the al-Qaeda-linked group Al-Shabaab attacked a hotel complex here in Nairobi. It killed dozens of people, including an American. The fear of terror attacks still lingers in the city. Security guards and metal detectors are regular features in most big buildings. Other parts of the continent, like the Sahel, are also confronting waves of violence that have been attributed to enduring terrorist threats. Niagale Bagayoko is with the Africa Security Sector Network.
I don't think that the international approach in terms of fighting global terrorism can be relevant in this context or in any other we can see everywhere else.
In the context of the Sahel, security threats come in a variety of forms, from community conflicts, local rebel groups, and yes, jihadi groups as well. But even those, she says, are highly localized, born out of local issues that governments need to address. That doesn't mean that they don't draw inspiration from international terror groups. Recently, the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, a coalition of various jihadi groups in the Sahel, congratulated the Taliban on their return to power.
Even before they entered Kabul, saying that they should be seen as an example of resilience and patience, which should inspire its own combatants.
20 years after the 9/11 terror attacks, experts in Africa say one thing is clear. The approach to countering terrorism needs to change. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Let's head to the courts now, Center Court, at Arthur Ashe Stadium, that is. Tomorrow is the U.S. Open's women's final, though you'd be excused for thinking it's a juniors match. Two teenagers, Emma Raducanu from the U.K. and Leila Fernandez from Canada, are squaring off in Flushing Meadow in Queens, New York. Sports writer Shira Springer joins us now. She writes about the intersection of sports and society. So this match between two teenagers, Raducanu and Fernandez, are we witnessing history here, Shira?
In some respect, we're witnessing history. It is the first time two teenagers have met in the final of a major since the 1999 U.S. Open, and that was when Serena Williams, who was then 17, defeated Martina Hingis, who was then 18. However, at that point in 1999, Williams and Hingis were already well-known tennis stars. That is not the case for Raducanu and Fernandez.
So I'm a tennis fan, but I didn't know about Raducanu. Only got hip to Fernandez in the round of 16. Are these two young women big surprises having reached the finals?
Well, I think the cognoscenti, so to speak, of the tennis world were the only ones who really knew potentially what these two were capable of. But Raducanu came into the tournament. She's from Britain. She's ranked 150th in the world. Fernandez from Canada is ranked 73rd in the world. So major surprises, particularly because of how difficult it has been for Fernandez to advance through the tournament. She had a very difficult draw. She had to defeat two former number one players to get to the final.
What are we witnessing here then with these two unseeded players in the finals of the US Open? Is this the next generation of women's champions, or am I just getting a little ahead of myself?
You might be getting a little bit ahead of yourself because, you know, if you look back, there always seems to be a new crop of young players, particularly young female players who are the next emerging star or stars. And, you know, the pressure gets to them, injuries get to them. It's a sport where you're very exposed, you're ranked, it's you alone on the court. And we have seen, in fact, how the pressure can get to players throughout this tournament. And let's not forget that earlier in the run-up to the final, Fernandez beat Naomi Osaka in the third round. And after that happened, Osaka basically said, you know, I'm not getting much joy from tennis anymore, and I'm going to take an indefinite break from the game.
So I'm already seeing Leila Fernandez pushed in front of the cameras after every match, and she's responding, you know, soundly. But I'm just wondering, with the story of Naomi Osaka that you just recounted, what do you think her story says about the pressures all these young women face?
This is always what I've heard about tennis, which is that it's a sport that can eat its young. And I think that's very true. You have players like Naomi Osaka who win when they are very young, again, pushed out in front of the cameras, sign tons of endorsement deals. And with that money and that exposure comes an increasing amount of pressure. And right now, Raducanu and Fernandez, they have the luxury, and it really is the luxury, of playing without pressure. They have not yet reached the stage of their young career when they are, you know, expectations heaped upon them. We'll really see what they're made of, and quite frankly, what their games are made of when that happens. And whoever wins this tournament, that's going to happen in a matter of weeks. So there will be a lot more pressure the next time both of these women take the court for the final, and then much more pressure once they take the court again following whatever happens in the final.
Shira Springer is a sports writer and journalist covering the intersection of sports and society. Shira, thank you very much. Great to speak with you.
Likewise. Thank you.
You spend time with the world every weekday to hear the voices and stories that connect you with places across the globe. The connection continues on social media. Find our team of journalists on Twitter. The handle is very easy to remember, at The World. You can find me there too. I'm at Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. One impact of the Taliban coming back to power, the fear of another strict censorship of musicians.
This will be a sad, dark period for Afghan music.
Also coming up, turns out there's a right way and a wrong way to transport a rhinoceros. Sometimes you just got to turn old assumptions upside down. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Over the past year, Russian President Vladimir Putin and Belarusian strongman Alexander Lukashenko have met five times. Yesterday, they had sit-down number six. This time, the two leaders announced concrete steps to further integrate the two nations' economies. For years, there's been speculation that Russia and Belarus are edging closer towards political reintegration. For more on the Russia-Belarus relationship, we're joined now by Alex Kokcharov. He's a political risk analyst based in London, where he focuses on Eurasia and the Caucasus. Alex, let's start with the announcement from Putin and Lukashenko yesterday. What does this actually mean for the two countries?
Well, it means that both Putin and Lukashenko have reached an agreement on the specifics of what the integration would entail, at least for the next several years. It includes significant harmonization and integration across multiple sectors of the economy, including tax and customs being harmonized, but also policy, including macroeconomic and monetary policy, being integrated and several markets becoming basically common markets. But we need to remember that Belarusian economy is about 3.5% of the Russian economy in terms of GDP, which means that the common rules means Russian rules. It means that Belarus would fundamentally transfer significant policymaking powers and also regulatory powers to Moscow.
Is this kind of an emergency measure for Belarus, considering the number of sanctions it's facing right now?
It is an emergency measure for the survival of Lukashenko's administration, which has been isolated by the Western sanctions and by the deterioration of relations with the West since last year.
So these two countries have taken a step towards further economic integration. What other areas do Russia and Belarus already have strong coordination or partnership?
They have strong coordination in both defense and military matters and also political matters. And yesterday, during the press conference in Moscow, Putin mentioned that they've agreed to establish a common defense area. We don't know what it entails, but it would likely mean more joint military exercises, more coordination on defense and military matters, and potentially Russian military bases in Belarus.
What's a little puzzling is that Russia and Belarus are already integrated in many ways, not the least of which is through the Commonwealth of Independent States. So what are Putin and Lukashenko actually trying to achieve with this?
Well, for Lukashenko, this is an attempt to extend his rule, which has been since July 1994, so over 27 years now. The only way for him to do it is to rely on continued economic and political support from Moscow. From the Russian perspective, Russia doesn't want transit of power in Belarus because there is an expectation that if there is a democratically elected government in Minsk, it would start drifting towards the West. And geopolitically, Russia wouldn't want to lose control over this area, which sits next to the Baltics, next to Poland and to Ukraine. Because for Russia, it's an area from which it can project military and political power into Eastern and Central Europe.
How did the protests of last summer's contested election in Belarus lead to these meetings between Putin and Lukashenko and affect the chain of events and how we got here with this announcement yesterday?
The protests of last year led to a significant deterioration of relations between Belarus and the West, as the West did not recognize the legitimacy of Lukashenko, as the election outcome was highly disputed by the opposition and the protesters. The widespread use of violence by the security forces against the protesters led to sanctions introduced against Lukashenko and his inner circle. While previously he could play a very delicate balancing act between Russia and the West, he is now in much weaker negotiating position. This was clear by around this time last year when Moscow publicly supported him and pledged to support him financially. This meant that in any negotiation with Russia, he would be in a weaker position and he would have to agree to the Russian concessions, which would be attached as conditions for the Moscow support, whether political or financial.
I mean, bottom line here, are we looking at Lukashenko remaining in power for a while?
Yes, we are. And it was clear again by September last year that with continued Russian support and the loyalty of the security forces and of the appointed officials in his administration, Lukashenko would be likely to keep power for at least a period of time. It doesn't mean that the sentiment within the country improved. There is still widespread anti-Lukashenko sentiment amongst Belarusians. So he's still in a precarious situation where he keeps his power thanks to external support from Moscow.
Alex Kokcharov is a political risk analyst with IHS Market in London, speaking with us about Russia and Belarus's announcement of further economic integration between the two countries. Alex, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This next story is about art, picking up the baton when justice feels unsatisfactory. In the early 2000s, members of a neo-Nazi cell in Germany killed 10 people. The trial for these hate crimes stretched on for more than a year. It rocked a nation that's worked hard to overcome the history of the Holocaust. The main defendant was found guilty, others were convicted, but for many, there were still unanswered questions and a lack of closure. A new theater project in Germany is now tackling these crimes, focusing on the victims. Stephanie Wolf reports from Weimar.
For Zima Zimzek, it's all too painful. She hasn't been able to bring herself to watch this new production yet. It is my story. It is our story, she says. And I will look at some things, but it's just too close to me. Zimzek's father, Enver, was the first victim of the neo-Nazi group, the National Socialist Underground, or the NSU, shot and killed in September of 2000 while operating a flower stand in Nuremberg, targeted for his Turkish background. Zimzak was only 14 when he was killed.
Er war ein guter Familienvater, also ich kann nur stolz auf ihn sein.
She says, he was a good family man, so I can only be proud of him. At the time, Zimzak's family didn't know about the NSU. In fact, German authorities spent years trying to link his murder and other similar killings to drug trafficking or a mafia operation. They even investigated Zimzak's mother, causing immense trauma for a family trying to mourn. Then, in 2011, investigators identified NSU members as suspects after two of them died by apparent suicide to avoid arrest. Zimzak says the news shocked her family.
Aber dann haben wir verstanden, dass es eigentlich um Rassismus geht. Das ist einfach.
But then we understood that it was actually about racism, she says. It's simple, because we look different, have a different name, a different origin, that he had to die because of this. Zimzak's father is one of the first faces you see as you walk into a former radio station in Weimar. Massive portraits of all 10 NSU victims hang from the ceiling, so large you're nearly eye to eye with them as you make your way back to the performance space where a theater piece called 438 Days of the NSU Trial is staged. The production opened this year's international art event, Kunstfest Weimar. It's described as a performance documentary, an abridged reenactment of the trial, told in 17 chapters over 17 days.
Verfahrensbeteiligte stellen Fragen an Beate Zschäpe.
You know, the trial is over, but for us, it's not over.
That's director Nuran David Kallis. There are no video or audio recordings of the trial. Kallis says the project's text draws on unofficial minutes, documented by journalists and a site called NSU Watch.
We didn't know what happened inside, and this is what we are showing tonight.
The reenactment features local residents, artists, politicians, and sometimes victim relatives reading the testimonies. Each chapter is live-streamed online.
Die Anklage geht davon aus, dass die Opfer ausgesucht wurden, weil sie Ausländer waren.
Kallis has dug into this subject before. And he's always asking the question, what went wrong?
How a group of people was able to kill so many people. And we show that our secret service systems are not working good.
During the trial, evidence emerged showing informants had come into contact with the NSU, raising questions about German authorities' failure to identify a group that seemed to be right under their noses. Sound designer Vivan Bacci remembers the drip of news coming out about the investigation, dumbfounded by how clumsy it all seemed. He believes racism played a role.
They couldn't imagine that there were right-wing terrorists, which there were hints, but they didn't follow these hints. They only followed imagination that this could only be connected to some kind of weird mafia and foreigners.
The reenactment is laid out chronologically as the violent events happened, rather than the order of the legal proceedings. Bacci says this was to make it more digestible, but also to focus on the victims.
Because during the whole trial and also with the media and everything, it's all very focused on the terrorists.
Rolf Hemke, the festival's artistic director, actually attended one day of the trial. Shortly after that, his mind was made up to present something on this during the festival. He says this work is not about entertainment.
This is a very technical procedure we are reenacting. So some people might be bored, some people might be shocked, some people might be just questioning what we are doing there. But this is exactly what the intention is. We want to tell people this is a big wound in the German post-war history and you have to be aware of that.
While it's hard for Zima Zimzek to watch painful memories play out on a stage, she supports projects like this. But Germany has seen more neo-Nazi attacks since the NSU trial. And so, she says, more needs to be done to tell this story, not just in the arts.
Und ich finde auch, dass NSU dieses, das gehört zu Deutschlands Geschichte. Das muss.
Zimzak thinks children should learn about this history, so they can grow up to be the ones to stop these cycles of hate. For The World, I'm Stephanie Wolf in Weimar, Germany.
On the first anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, I went to New York to speak with artists, to hear their thoughts on what had happened to their city in the wake of the attacks. One of them was an Afghan musician who goes simply by Qureshi. Now, remember that by 2002, the U.S. military was in Afghanistan. They had routed the Taliban from power, but the mission there was not over. 20 years of grinding war and attempts at nation building had just begun. And the Afghan musician I spoke with at the time, Qureshi, he was worried for his native country and still, after a year, for his adopted home of New York. Recently, I reached out again to Qureshi, still a proud New Yorker. You and I spoke on the first anniversary of 9/11. That was in 2002. You were on tour overseas when the planes went into the World Trade Center. Remind me how you felt back in New York City after you returned.
Actually, I was stuck for an extra week in London. And then when I came here, I live downtown New York City. Nothing seems like normal like before. It was kind of empty, sad, and kind of depressing. It took some while to be back to normal.
And for you especially, it took some time. About a week later, we started to see, the world started to see the connections between 9/11 and your home country. I just want to play a segment of our conversation from the time.
Then all of a sudden we have this news that we're hoping that somehow Afghanistan should not be involved in these things and it shouldn't be. But unfortunately it was. It was out of our control. But we have to deal with this other catastrophe that what takes in Afghanistan. And we also, as I hear, like everyone hears, a lot of innocent people died. So this is very sad, especially for Afghanistan, that we've been in war, in civil war for the past 20 years.
So Qureshi, that was you 19 years ago. I mean, it is so surreal to hear that now. Once again, the Taliban are in power. What are you feeling right now?
I am shocked, as all other Afghans, even non-Afghans, whoever hear the news. I'm totally shocked. The turn of events and the drastic changes. The best word to describe is shocked. I'm totally shocked.
I want to focus on what you do and your instrument, the rubab, singular to Afghanistan, similar in some ways, for people who don't know, to the sitar, i.e. it's stringed and with added sympathetic resonating strings, which give it that distinctive sound. What happened to rubab music under the Taliban when they were in power in the 1990s? And do you expect to see a ban on playing the rubab or performing or playing of any music?
Yeah, that's what I hear. This is one of the very sad thing for me. That's what is affect me in this instrument. At that time, I heard they broke some of these rubabs, and whoever had it, they hide it. So I don't know what's gonna happen this time, because everybody's they're talking about they changed. But I'm not sure. So I'm here. I don't know what's going to happen. But what I hear, music is not allowed. So this will be a sad, dark period for Afghan music.
I mean, you've not been in Afghanistan basically since 1983, correct?
I went, actually, they invited me. I think it was 2016. I went there for a performance. It was great to be back there. Then I really enjoyed being there. The music scene was there. There were a lot of young Afghan rubab players. And there were a couple of schools. And to their surprise, they were very surprised that I kept this instrument alive all these years that I was away from Afghanistan. And I played it the traditional way how it should be played. So that was a good thing, but I don't know what's going to happen to them in this situation.
Given the connections 9/11 has now two times with your home of Afghanistan, I mean, stepping back, what does the 20th anniversary of 9/11 mean to you, Qureshi?
It's very sad, and it's very sad Afghanistan to be part of this, and very sad and a very dark chapter, but at the same time, very sad for those people that they lost their lives not too far from where I live. And actually, the buildings that I was also working there, sometimes I was working there.
In the World Trade Center.
Yes, and I knew those buildings. I've been to those buildings many, many times. So every time I would pass by afterwards, actually, after a couple of weeks when I returned from my tour, at that time when I say that the 9/11 took place, I would go there sometimes to see that scene. It was horrific, and I had nightmares. So that was very sad, and it's still sad in many people's memory.
New York City resident and Afghan musician Qureshi speaking with me 19 years after we first met. You're listening to Qureshi's composition, Kabul, New York, a nod of his to two cultures. In China, June 4th is a well-known date, one the government there studiously does not recognize. It's the day in 1989 when Chinese soldiers rolled into Tiananmen Square and killed hundreds, perhaps thousands, of protesters. The numbers are fuzzy because Chinese authorities have done their best to erase the history of what actually happened in Beijing. But in Hong Kong, June 4th is observed every year. There's even a June 4th museum. Or rather, there was. Hong Kong police raided the museum yesterday and have arrested four members of the organization that ran it. Professor Sharon Yam is from Hong Kong. She teaches rhetoric at the University of Kentucky and joins us now from her home in Lexington. Professor, how did you hear about this raid? And what was your first thought?
So I heard about it through the news and Twitter sphere and also other Hong Kong activists. So my first thought is, unfortunately, I am not surprised, because the leaders and the organizers of Hong Kong Alliance, who runs the museum, has come under a lot of legal fire from the government for insisting to still commemorate the event.
So some of the people who run the June 4th Museum had been arrested before the raid. At first, in the Chinese Hong Kong crackdown, we saw activists arrested. Trials began. There was the man who ran a motorcycle into police who was tried and sentenced to prison. But this is a museum. Can you help us understand how widespread the crackdown on dissent is in Hong Kong?
So the crackdown in Hong Kong extends not only to prominent activist legislators, but in fact seeps into people's everyday lives. The national security law affects not just the select few, as the Hong Kong government had repeatedly said, but in fact, it really is felt in people's life as we kind of walk through the city.
So tell us about Hong Kong's June 4th Museum, Sharon. Why and when was it established, and what makes the June 4th date itself important to Hong Kongers?
So the June 4th Museum took place a few years ago before the 2019 protest. And Hong Kong, in fact, is the only place under China's sovereignty that still commemorate June 4th, that particular event. So hence, being able to have a museum that hosts June 4th artifacts, timelines, and interviews within China, that in and of itself was seen as somewhat subversive move by the regime.
Have you visited the museum, Sharon? And like, how did the exhibits speak to you?
Yes, I have visited the museum. Despite the fact that the Chinese government has been censoring open discussions on the internet and in public about that, the museum is a place and a space to gather so many of the artifacts and putting them, contextualizing them in a way that allow the loved ones of the victims to shine through and really contextualize the event of that day, really demonstrating how a lot of the political suppression and persecution still persists to this day.
Sharon, the world has been watching for a couple of years now as the Chinese mainland tightens the screws on Hong Kong with the national security law. What do you think is the most critical thing for our listeners to understand about Hong Kong today and where things are headed?
I think that it is difficult to, keep our attention on a city that seems so far from the United States, right? I think what is something important to bear in mind is that even though the national security law, it's really cracking down not just on political dissent, but also on the civil society writ large. But there are still people, grassroots activists, and people in their everyday life trying to live according to their integrity, even though the situation is making that increasingly difficult to do. So I think what I hope listeners to understand is that the national security law, it turned into educational curriculum in schools. It has a snitching hotline that promote peer surveillance among Hong Kongers.
Do you have family living in Hong Kong today? And what do they tell you about life there now?
My immediate families all currently live in Hong Kong, and even talking to my parents and relatives, some of them have been thinking of immigrating, leaving Hong Kong. A lot of my friends have done so already. In fact, I think over the last few months, thousands of people have fled Hong Kong, not necessarily because they are in immediate danger of persecution, but because they do not find life under extreme persecution livable.
Sharon Yam teaches at the University of Kentucky, speaking with us about the June 4th Museum in Hong Kong and why it was raided by police. Professor Yam, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Finally, you've got your Nobel Prizes, prestigious commendations in science, literature, and of course, peacemaking. And then there are the Ig Nobels, awards for the silliest science experiments. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports on a few of this year's standout winners.
Ig Nobel Prizes are supposed to, and I'm quoting from the website here, honor achievements that first make you laugh and then make you think. The winner in the transportation category could be the poster child for that. A team of researchers from all over the world studied what happens when you hang rhinos upside down for 10 minutes by their ankles. Now, what came to mind when I heard that was those long silk scarves that hang down from the ceiling in circus tents, you know, that the acrobats do all those cool tricks on. But instead of acrobats, there are rhinos, like all tangled up, like in Cirque du Soleil. That was a dramatization. No animals were harmed in the making of this radio story. Turns out, my mental image was way off the mark. The scientists conducted this experiment at the request of the Namibian government. They wanted to know if it's safe to hang rhinos upside down by their feet so they can airlift them via helicopter, which is something conservationists have to do from time to time to evacuate rhinos from poaching hotspots and to move them to different areas to ensure the species maintains genetic diversity. And I should mention the rhinos are tranquilized first. What the Ig Nobel winners discovered was that hanging upside down is actually easier on the animal's heart and lung function than the alternative, which is laying the sleeping rhinos on their sides or on their chests in the back of a truck. Some of the night's other big winners, the prestigious Ig Nobel Peace Prize, went to three scientists who looked into whether humans evolved beards to protect themselves from punches to the face, and the prize in medicine went to a team that found that sex can relieve nasal congestion. I will spare you my audio rendition of that one. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
And that is definitely going to do it for us today. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston at GBH. I'm Marco Werman. Carol Hills will be in the host chair next week. You stay safe, be strong, and have a great weekend.